First, I should say that I have no financial relationships to disclose. So I'll be covering a little bit about a few highlights in terms of what the journey has been like within APHA doing advocacy around this issue. I'll give a little bit of background, but I think each of our presenters will be giving some background, too, about the region, so I probably won't spend a long amount of time on background about the region. But mostly what I really want to cover in the short time that I have today is to talk a little bit about what has it been like trying to do this advocacy within APHA. And Nancy's going to wrap up the presentation, which I think will be an opportunity for us to think about after we've heard from these other disciplines as well. What might it take for us to continue moving APHA forward, and what is it going to require of its members in order to make some movement on the health and human rights issues involved in the conflict? So just a little bit of geographic conflict or context. Like I said, I'm not going to cover it a huge amount, but I did want to provide a little bit. Estimated number of Palestinians living in the territory is about 4.4 million, and about 2.7 million reside in the West Bank and 1.7 in the Gaza Strip. As you'll see from a variety of maps that I think some of our other presenters are going to show, it's highly fragmented geographically, and that will become more clear throughout the presentations. What I'm going to talk about is a little bit more specifically about what that has meant for health care and health and well-being in the region. Which is really the impetus for the advocacy efforts within APHA. So just some examples of some of that fragmentation. This is a picture of roadblocks. This is a picture of a fence, which is part of sort of the infamous wall built around the West Bank. And this picture I took through some work that I was doing with the Palestinian Medical Relief Society. So one of the things that I was doing with them was documenting the impacts of the closures on healthcare provision. So they wanted to show me, for instance, that many of the roads that they would take to get to people to provide care, whether that's emergency care or primary care, were blocked off in such a way that it either took them an incredible amount of time to get to the people that they needed to care for, or in a lot of cases it was downright impossible, and I'll talk about that. Checkpoints are all over the West Bank, and that also was part of the challenges of healthcare workers delivering care. Not only the checkpoint itself, but the process of people, of soldiers, examining the ambulances, examining the mobile clinic vehicles, holding them up, as well as, for instance, healthcare workers talking about downright harassment or violence on the part of by the soldiers. So that was the geographic context. Now I want to provide you the philosophical context. You know, why is it important that within APHA we're concerned about this? First of all, we all know that as public health leaders, we have an obligation to ensure that people have fair access to medical care, and that's regardless of their political surroundings. And in fact, not just so much regardless of their political surroundings, but in fact, if their political surroundings are particularly contentious, then it's especially important for us to be upholding our obligation that people be able to obtain health care. Secondly, it's really important to note that those of us that have worked on various drafts of the resolutions have really thought about the way that the resolutions align with APHA policy priorities. Specifically, the three main priorities of APHA are addressing public health infrastructure, ensuring the right to health and health equity, and health care, and creating health equity. Thirdly, any movement, whether it's a resolution or a different kind of advocacy within the organization, really continues the record that APHA has of advocating for access of people everywhere to conditions that support public health and access to medical care, even in or perhaps particularly in situations of political conflict and war. So as a professional organization, we're well positioned to call, for instance, not only for to support human rights calls, but also to call for increased collaboration, especially among health and human rights groups. We're in a good position to support diplomacy efforts and advocacy for health and human rights. And then there's also a very sort of practical rationale, which is that many organizations are already taking a stand on this issue, and APHA will be left behind if we don't advocate, especially for instance, sort of the bare minimum, which would be responsible financial investment when the health issues regarding conflict become clear. So we've done that for things like alcohol, tobacco, and the weapons industry, because those are largely recognized as issues that have public health implications, and therefore it's important for public health professionals to take a stand on those issues, particularly regarding financial investment in corporations that benefit from these kinds of industries. So APHA resolutions, I didn't know that much about APHA resolutions or the importance of these resolutions before I was mentored into the advocacy process within APHA. And since then, I've gotten to see a lot about why resolutions are important within our organization. I think the main thing to know is that APHA resolutions really pave way for member advocacy, and they provide a really good venue for us to promote and shape professional responses to important public health issues. Again, stands that other organizations have taken, especially because taking a stand is part of upholding our professional duty. I won't read all of these, but I wanted to put just a few highlights of previous resolutions that we drew on to support the rationale for us to create a resolution based specifically on health in Palestine. So I guess you've gotten a chance to read a few of those at least. One example, for instance, of the one in Nicaragua talked about an end to the conflict and upholding human health and human rights in Nicaragua. So I think that that's an important sort of example. After listing all the resolutions, I also thought to myself, I took a little break from working on the slides and thought, why else does it matter? And I remembered the colleagues that I had worked with and what they said to me, which was, we're counting on you. You know, I said to them as I did my research with them, what can I do to give back? I don't want to just come and do research. So in its most simple sense, it's important for us to do advocacy because our public health colleagues around the world are counting on us. It's not to say that there's not incredible advocacy work being done from within Palestine, but the way that we honor that is to also recognize our unique position, especially being in the United States, and think about what do we owe our public health colleagues around the world, and particularly in countries that are suffering from policies created by our government. So simply, I would say, because our public health colleagues count on us. And that, I think, is one of the main reasons to think about doing advocacy within our professional organization on this issue. So some context of the conflict prior to 2008, and I won't be giving a complete detailed chronology of the conflict. But I do want to say just generally that as we have been working on the resolution, we've investigated the multiple ways that the conflict affects health. Palestinian health individually and collectively is undermined by both the military and administrative conditions created by the Israeli occupation. So health effects are both direct, which you can see very clearly, for instance, through shelling and drone attacks and home invasions. So you can obviously see and notice that that would be a very acute sort of public health consequence. But there are also a number of indirect consequences that occur because of things like restriction on movement, reduced flow of medical and building supplies, and ongoing tactics of control and humiliation. So all things that affect health in ways that we perhaps might not notice at first, but especially the more we think about the importance of not just sort of health in a simple sense, but health in terms of the context in which we live, you can see that living within this ongoing protracted conflict, whether you're in the West Bank, which is a little bit distinct from Gaza, or you're in Gaza, is going to affect your life and your trajectory. So some examples, the flow of medical and building supplies, there's been serious consequences in terms of the number of medications and equipment that's been allowed into the various areas in the Palestine territory. There's also major health crises in terms of other areas, including access to food, water, and electricity, the effects on maternal and child health, the effects on mental health, and certainly the effects on health systems. So given this, really, as far as I know, some of the main energy for creating a resolution really started in 2008. And this was with a late breaker that was submitted to APHA with a real focus on Gaza. The resolution was forwarded to the Governing Council by the Joint Policy Committee, where it was discussed and then tabled by actually a pretty close vote. And since this time, you'll see when I run through some of the other slides, this advocacy on this issue has been also deeply entwined with some of the internal politics of the organization, which has been something that many of us on the team that have been working on the resolution have been thinking about. 2009, there was a major operation in Gaza. Many more were killed. The occupation of the West Bank continued. There were lots of activities in 2009. In February, a new resolution focused on Gaza specifically, and this was done through a new, through the normal policy process. It was rejected by the executive board, and at the annual meeting, a proposal was made to review the policy development process, partly in terms of how the resolution and appeal were treated, particularly regarding a lack of transparency. So I won't go through all of the text on that slide, but I just want to say that so a lot of the work on dealing with the resolution was also thinking about how are resolutions dealt with within the organization and what might need to be done differently so that there's more transparency and there's more understanding of what creates the conditions where a resolution like this can pass. In 2010, there was no new resolution. In 2011, there was also no new resolution, but there was a lot of work done, specifically working on TIA CREFT to try and think about divesting from the occupation and the public health importance of this. In 2012, more attacks were launched. There were lots of political events that were happening, and the occupation of the West Bank continued, of course. APHA met in San Francisco at that time. There was a new resolution, and it was again rejected, but this time authors spoke with representatives of the JPC, and there were again some new rules that were adopted for policy development, but the implementation of those rules were still dragging along rather slowly. In 2013, APHA met in Boston. This was last year. A policy statement was submitted on the full occupation, and there were new standards and new format. We got a conditional approval. At the hearing, members spoke two and one in favor of the resolution. There was a huge support from APHA membership, including 500 who signed a petition of support. However, the JPC announced a recommendation that all other resolutions be on the consent agenda and were approved, but the resolution on Palestine, they recommended its rejection because it was called unbalanced and too controversial. Now, we worked on this resolution for over a year, really trying to figure out, you know, not only our responsibility as public health professionals, but what it meant to provide a real background that was backed by scientific evidence. So we had over 50 peer-reviewed sources that we drew on, as well as a lot of gray literature supporting the health effects of the occupation. We didn't put opinions in. We didn't put a lot of history in. Our point of it was not to solve a larger conflict or to even think about some of the context of the larger conflict, but rather to talk specifically about the well-documented health consequences. So that brings us to now. Currently, our strategy is trying to develop leadership to sponsor a study tour. I think what we've decided is to take a little bit of a shift, and Nancy will talk a lot more about that. So if people have questions about that, Nancy will talk a lot more about that. Oh, what the vote was last year?
75% said no in the governing council, not in the organization as a whole, just the governing council.
So that brings us to today. Like I said, at the end of all of the presentations, Nancy will give an update of where we are today. But in terms of reflecting on what the history of working on this resolution tell us, first of all, I think that it indicates a really poor understanding among public health professionals, particularly in this country, about the effects of the occupation on Palestinian health. As I mentioned, the resolution and the details that we provided were not meant to be any sort of opinion, but rather to summarize the scientific evidence on this issue, which is relatively uncontroversial in the rest of the world. But in terms of here, results suggest that fear of controversy really interferes in a lot of ways with what should be a reasoned response by U.S. public health professionals to an urgent issue of health justice. So I'm excited to hear from other people in terms of the strategies and the context of their journeys with this and to talk more as we wrap up the presentation today. Thank you. Thank you.